Our Lady of Chivalry, excerpts taken from The Life of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Mother of God, with the History of the Devotion to Her, translated from the French of the Abbé Orsini by Mrs. J. Sadler. The Barbarous Times. The invasion of the barbarians was, for religion, as for the nations which live inveterated and civilized under the shadow of the Roman eagles, a period of mourning, of terror, and of tears, a night of blood, illumined by the distant glare of the conflagrations, resounding with the clash of arms, and crossed by warlike chiefs who took to themselves the fearful title of Scourges of God. When the sound of this great passage of men had ceased, and it became possible to distinguish objects through the smoke of conflagrations and the dust of battlefields, it was found that Europe had changed its face. The Saxons occupied fertile England, the Franks had taken possession of Gaul, the Goths of Spain and the Lombards of Italy. There remained not a single vestige of the sciences, the arts, or the institutions of the mighty people of Romulus. Barbarism had invaded all and swept away all before it. New forms of government, new laws, new customs were everywhere observed. One thing only had resisted the general transformation, Christianity, which was to console the conquered and humanize the conquerors. The devotion to Mary, impeded for a while by Arianism, which was fatally predominant for some time after the invasion of the Goths and Vandals, flourished again under the victorious banners of the Franks. Clovis, the only Catholic king of his time, conceived the design of the building at the eastern extremity of the city, under the invocation of Our Lady, a metropolitan church, of which he himself laid the first stone, and which was completed by his son, Childebert. This church, built on the site of an ancient Druid temple, was adorned with marbled columns, frescoes on a golden ground, and a mosaic pavement. The poet-bishop Fortunatus gives special praise to its windows, which filled the interior with a flood of light. These windows were a luxury imported from Greece and Italy, and were then first introduced into the Gauls. But of all the pious foundations in honor of the Blessed Virgin which date from these remote times, there is none more worthy of note than that of Our Lady of Treves, in that ancient county of Troyes, the fatherland of the Franks, which then made part of the Duchy of Austria. Who does not remember the popular legend of Genevieve of Brabant, that moving tale, sung by so many troubadours and minstrels in the baronial halls of the feudal times, and told by the cottage hearth for 1,000 years and more, this story of the barbarous ages, attested by a monument, commemorates a most tragical event, a true drama from which Shakespeare perhaps drew, for he loved to draw from ancient chronicles, the two most powerful characters that his fancy ever produced, Iago, the traitor and calumniator, and Othello, the hero with the credulous mind and jealous heart. Siegfried, Palatine of Treves, reluctantly tears himself from the arms of a beloved wife to go fight the Moors under the glorious banner of Charles Martel. Golo, the master of the prince's household, to whom he had confided the care of his young wife, a model of virtue and a pearl of beauty, conceived a shameful passion for the princess, and was not slow in declaring it. Repulsed with the contempt which his treason merited, the unworthy favorite, who had deliberately planned his lord's disgrace, hesitated not to calumniate the woman whom he could not seduce, for all vices are sisters. Siegfried believed him. He was far away from home. He loved his wife madly and was jealous. In the first burst of what he considers his just indignation, he condemned Genevieve to die, together with her child. But the servants charged to execute this fatal sentence in the depth of a dark forest had not the heart to do it, and the Belgian princess was left with her newborn infant in that gloomy forest, peopled only with wild beasts. The child was suckled by a wild doe. For 6 long years did the innocent and injured wife live on roots and wild fruits, constantly begging of God that her innocence might be recognized. The compassionate virgin, touched by so many tears and so much misery, came to her one day as she sat by a spring and promised her that her wishes should be accomplished. Soon after, Siegfried, who still loved his wife and was inconsolable for her loss, being on a hunting party, found Genevieve in a cave, covered with rags, her long hair hanging over her shoulders like a veil. Golo confessed his crime and was torn asunder by four wild bulls from the Black Forest. This act of stern justice being done, Genevieve had a church built in honor of Mary amid the woods where she had so long wandered, and on the very spot where the Mother of God had appeared to her. Haedophilus, Archbishop of Treves, consecrated this church in the year 746. Gaul was not entirely converted to the gospel. Under the Merovingian kings, the Franks had completely abjured their fierce German deities, but there were still some vestiges of polytheism amongst the Romans of the cities, who continued to draw omens from the flight and singing of birds, to feast on Thursday in honor of Jupiter, to swear by Neptune, Pluto, Diana, or the Geni. In fine, who dared to light lamps and hang up offerings in the deserted temples of the idols, for which St. Eloy reproaches them in his homilies. These frail shoots of Greek and Roman idolatry soon withered of themselves on an adverse soil, but the religion of the Celts stoutly resisted the sacerdotal acts, and it was ages before it died away. So late as the 4th century, the image of the goddess Berecynthia, representing cultivated ground, was born through the fields. In the 5th, it is decreed by a canon of the Second Council of Arles that if a baron permits lamps to be lit before trees, rocks, or fountains, he shall be cut off from the communion of the faithful, after being first admonished and solemnly warned. At the end of the 6th century, the Council of Auxerre forbids vows being made to bushes, trees, or fountains. In the Council of Nantes, the date of which is fixed by Flodard at the year 658, the bishops are advised to uproot the trees which the Britons still persist in worshipping, and from which they would not, on any account, cut a single branch. The priest Paulinus represents these same Gauls as having relapsed into their former idolatry, placing meats on the sacred stones at the foot of the trees, and beseeching a venerable oak, which was probably the sepulchre of some old chief druid, with the humble fernal offerings of a handful of beech nuts, to protect their wives, their children, their servants, and their houses. The bishops of Charlemagne's time likewise pronounced severe penalties against these superstitions, which had outlived the Merovingian dynasty, and they must have been still of some account when the church passed laws against them, so late as the opening years of the 9th century. It was especially in the two Armoricas, east and west, where the gospel was late sown and of slow growth, that the native worship, favored by force as old of the world itself, long held its ground despite of councils and bishops, who, nevertheless, strained every nerve to root it out. The deserts of Sissi in the Cotentin Peninsula was peopled, even in the 7th century, by pagan Gauls, who lived there, as we learn from the canons of some of the councils of those times, positively like wild beasts. But if idolatry was obstinately sustained by the scalds and bards and some druids wandering in the woods, the zealous Christians had the ardor which secures victory, and proved it well. In the depth of these remote solitudes, said to be the haunts of demons, where strange things were indeed revealed, when the torches of the Gauls, who repaired by night to some forbidden rite, flashed in the foliage of the mighty oaks, or formed a fiery circle around some dark dolmen planted on the moonlight heath, hermits, often of high birth, took up their dwellings in clay huts, covered with brambles, some hidden by a coat of mingled moss and ivy. Their beds were of dry leaves, sometimes the bark of trees. Their food consisted of fruits, berries, and wild roots. Their garments, a toga, or gown of white coarse wool. Making their way through the tall, tangled ferns of those primeval forests, whose secret ways they knew not, these good shepherds sought out in every direction the stray sheep of Christ. When the good odor of the sanctity of one of these solitaries spread abroad through the old Neustrian woods, other hermits hastened to place themselves under his guidance. Then they set about clearing the hard, dry earth, choked up for ages with briars and brambles. Then the yellow crops began to wave on the fair hillside. Then, at the calm evening hour, when the birds sat warbling on the trees, the hymns of Sedilius, in honor of the Virgin Mary, arose in grave, sweet tones from the very places where the victims doomed to die under the stone knife of the sacrifices to appease the Gaelic gods had of old chanted his death song. Women, ever ready, notwithstanding her natural timidity, to brave all dangers when occasion requires, women would fain contribute her share to the overthrow of paganism, and bravely advance to attack it, even in its ancient strongholds, under the protection of Mary. Saint Fremund, a nobleman who had grown disgusted with the world, and who was forced to receive the episcopal crown in his humble cell, founded a monastery of nuns in his beloved solitude. And this convent is one of the first of Neustrian Armorica of which there is any record. The holy bishop added to it a handsome church which he dedicated to the Mother of God. This monastery, built about the year 674, was destroyed by the idolatrous Romans, but was rebuilt with increased splendor by their Christian descendants.